Daniel chapter 5, starting at verse 1. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and shall have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then came on all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. And then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. There is a man in thy kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. For as much as an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, he will show the interpretation." Then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said unto Daniel, "Art thou that Daniel which are the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Jewry? I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, and that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of it. And I have heard of thee, that thou canst make interpretation and dissolve doubts. Now if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about thy neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let thy gifts be to thyself and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known unto him the interpretation. O thou king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew, and whom he would, he kept alive, and whom he would, he set up, and whom he would, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was like the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appoints over it whomsoever he wills. and you, his son, O Belshazzar, has not humbled thy heart, though thou knewest all this, but has lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven. And they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords and thy wives and thy concubines have drunk wine in them, and thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is, and in whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the writing that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God has numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balance and are found wanting. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. The story in Daniel 5 seems like it is an abrupt shift from what we've been reading in Daniel. We've gotten to know Nebuchadnezzar. But Daniel 4 closes his story, and Daniel 5 opens with Nebuchadnezzar being a distant memory. It's probably about 25 years after the events of Daniel 4 that we're reading here. But as the story shifts gears, it's only going to be a surprise for those who have forgotten how the book of Daniel began. It's only unexpected if you sort of step outside of the experience and expectation of the people of God. Daniel and the other prophets have been foreshadowing the events of Daniel 5 for some time. The first thing you need to remember is Isaiah 44, verse 28. Isaiah 44, verse 28 says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built, and to the temple, your foundation shall be laid. So the prophet Isaiah, over 150 years before the events of Daniel 5, as he is prophesying about the captivity and the restoration of God's people, says that God is going to use a man named Cyrus to restore the temple and to release the people from captivity. So pack that, store that away in the back of your head for a minute. Then look at Daniel chapter 1 and see how Daniel begins his book. In Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels unto the treasure house of his God. So Daniel is foreshadowing the events of chapter 5 and the very beginning of the book. He's telling us that Nebuchadnezzar's conquest was not just to carry away people. Nebuchadnezzar's conquest was to carry away some treasure. The Babylonians carried away some of the vessels of the temple as treasures to worship their own false gods. But look at what else Daniel says at the end of chapter 1. The very last verse of Daniel chapter 1, this young man has been taken into captivity and made a slave in Babylon. And it says in the last verse of chapter 1, Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. So at the end of Daniel 1, we're looking forward to this fulfillment of God's old promise. If God can't fulfill the prophecy that he penned the prophet Isaiah over 150 years earlier, then none of the promises that he's going to make through Daniel, none of the prophecies of this book mean anything. But Cyrus is coming. The sovereign God of history is revealing his will and his plan through Daniel just as surely as he was working through Isaiah. He is in control of all of this. And God demonstrated his control of human history by causing that wicked, powerful Nebuchadnezzar to humble himself and bring glory to God. That's what we've been reading so far in Daniel. Remember, he had bragged about how he was able to carry away the riches of the temple in Jerusalem, as well as the people of Judah. Daniel, the captive of Judah, had warned him, don't think too highly of yourself. And yet in chapter 4, there he was, the king of the great empire ruling in this magnificent city. The city of Babylon is massive. It was the New York City of its day. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon are one of the ancient wonders of the world. The walls we've talked about surrounding this city that's about 15 miles square were at least 4 stories high. Some people say up to 30 stories high if you believe some of the ancient exaggerated historians. The walls were thick enough that chariots could be ridden on the top of the wall and pass each other coming and going. And so Nebuchadnezzar had said in Daniel 4, verse 30 and 31, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? And while the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from you. And if you remember, we read the rest of that chapter. Nebuchadnezzar was stricken with madness. He was living in the fields, eating grass like an animal. His hair growing out, matting together. Nails growing out like bird's claws. And for 7 years, God made the greatest king on earth to crawl on his hands and knees in the mud. Until once those 7 prescribed years had passed, God granted Nebuchadnezzar his mind back. And at the end of chapter 4, which was written by Nebuchadnezzar himself, we read one of the most wonderful and unexpected chapters of the Old Testament. God takes that wicked, prideful king and changes him completely. In chapter 4, verses 34 through 37, at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes into heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and praised him, and honored him that lives forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, his kingdom from generation to generation. And all of the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stop him or say to him, what doest thou? At the same time, my reason returned to me, for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and brightness returned, and my counselors and lords sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride, he is able to abase. He is able to bring the proud low. And that's the end of Nebuchadnezzar's story. And then chapter 5 opens with Belshazzar doing what? Nebuchadnezzar had experienced this spectacular conversion, and he got this attitude adjustment in regard to the God of Israel. He is to be praised. He is to be honored. He is to be respected. He's going to strike down the arrogance of those who oppose him. That history is the backdrop for Daniel chapter 5. The kings of Babylon who followed Nebuchadnezzar did not learn the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar wanted them to learn. And so over 20 years has passed between the end of Daniel 4 and the beginning of Daniel 5. Just to give you some of the history, Nebuchadnezzar's died. A son named Amel-Marduk comes to the throne. He only rules for 2 years. He's actually sort of notorious. Other places in the scripture, it calls him Evil Merodach, which is a great name. He is murdered and replaced by Nergal-Sharezer. He dies after only 4 years, and his young son is murdered shortly after becoming king, and a man named Nabonidus comes to the throne. And Nabonidus is an interesting character, historically speaking. It seems he married into the royal family. Almost assuredly, he married one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters in order to sort of legitimize his reign. Historians suggest that since he didn't worship the god of Babylon named Marduk, he was unpopular. He chose to live outside the city, closer to where he was from, and his son Belshazzar was named co-regent, co-ruler, remained in Babylon and ruled from the city while Nabonidus ruled from afar and led the army. That makes Belshazzar, in chapter 5, the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. This chapter uses the term father, but it's using that term the way Hebrews always use that term, just to mean ancestor. When Daniel 5 opens, the Medo-Persian Empire, led by a man named Cyrus, remember that name? Is growing and it's threatening Babylon. Nabonidus had taken the army out to meet Cyrus in battle, but he had no idea what he was getting into. Word of his father's defeat may or may not have gotten to Belshazzar. But what he does know for sure is that the Medo-Persian army is out there beyond the walls of Babylon, and they're busy with some weird earth-moving project. Belshazzar probably thought they were trying to either build a ramp or to dig under the walls. But inside the city, nobody is all that threatened by them. The city's massive walls can't be broken or climbed. It has protected towers everywhere. It's estimated to have 20 years worth of food and the ability to grow more. The Euphrates River flows through the city. It flows underneath the walls of the city of Babylon. So they always have a constant provision of water. Maybe the Medo-Persians could defeat Nabonidus out there, but Belshazzar is ruling inside the fortified city, and he couldn't be brought to care about it too much. I should note everything discovered by archaeologists in regard to these men has matched the biblical story. For century after century, Daniel 5 was one of those chapters that was pointed to say, well, look, the Bible's inaccurate. It's a fairy tale. There's nobody in history named Belshazzar. But in 1854, archaeologists discovered some artifacts called the Cylinders of Nabonidus, which indicate that King Nabonidus made his son Belshazzar co-regent in the city of Babylon. He's not just mentioned once. He's mentioned like over 30 times in that thing. Archaeologists have actually uncovered the banquet hall in Babylon that would hold as many as 10,000 people, so that probably every important person in Babylon was present at this hall that night. And they've also found, just like verse 5 says, the walls of the banquet hall were plastered. And so Belshazzar, the co-regent of Babylon, grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, calls for the relics of God's temple to be brought out so they can use them in their drunken orgy celebrating the pagan gods of Babylon. They're seeking help from their pagan gods. Verse 4 calls them the gods of silver and brass and gold and silver and brass and iron and wood and stone. Don't you just love how that list gets less valuable as you go? Even the king's name Belshazzar means protected by Bel, one of the gods of Babylon. And so as Daniel 5 opens, several things are happening at once. The king is throwing this drunken party for the leadership of Babylon as as a statement that they're not really worried about the threat of the Medo-Persian army outside the walls. This feast is more of a drunken orgy, frankly, is what I'd call it. Verse 1 says the king is getting drunk in front of his lords. Verse 2 describes the princes drinking too. Verse 2 and 3 also mention the wives and concubines to let us know exactly what kind of party this is. It is drunken revelry with explicit sexual overtones. And so this feast also has a pagan religious component to it. As repugnant as such a thing would be to the true God, celebrations like this were part of pagan praise. Verse 4 says they drank wine and praised those gods of gold, silver, brass, iron, wood, and stone. And within that praise is a calculated act of blasphemy against Yahweh, the God of Israel. It is a deliberate offense against their creator. Now, there's a couple of reasons they might be doing this. First, since Babylon had conquered many countries and carried away the treasures of all of those false gods too, it might be something that they just did as a matter of routine. They took their opportunities to show our gods are better than your gods. And it just happened to be Israel's turn. More likely, though, the point of this ceremony is something deeper and more specific. We'll see in a moment when we get to verse 22 that Belshazzar knows that great King Nebuchadnezzar, his grandfather, had a change of heart about the God of Israel. He was converted and praised Yahweh. If you remember, chapter 4 is actually Nebuchadnezzar's royal decree about his conversion. So the events of Daniel leading up to this are all known to Belshazzar. He knows his grandfather had a dream. He knows that dream about a statue promised that Babylon would succumb to a lesser kingdom. Remember, Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, well, you are that head of gold, but another kingdom, an inferior kingdom, will arise after you. So Yahweh, the God of Israel, had proclaimed an end to the Babylonian Empire. But Belshazzar's party here is an act of defiance against that prophecy. What he's saying is, look, I am not threatened by that army out there, and I'm not threatened by the prophecy of some ridiculous, invisible God of Israel. Much like his grandfather had defied that promise by making that statue of all gold, Belshazzar is defying it by throwing this party to honor the false gods as a sacrilegious act to intentionally mock and purposefully defy the God of Israel. God is going to crash this party. It's not hard to imagine the king standing, holding a cup from the temple in his hand and proclaiming some grand toast to one of the Babylonian gods when he stops mid-sentence and stares at the wall, and everyone's stare goes with him to that point on the wall. You know, if you look over and there's a spider on the wall, you might be able to go on, but when you look over and the thing crawling on the wall is fingers of a man's hand, party's over. And these fingers intend to be seen. Right? The way it worked is those white plaster walls, they would be able to light the room by putting candlesticks or lampstands up close to the wall as a reflection. Well, verse 5 says the fingers appeared over against the candlestick. So in the brightest place of the room, readily visible to everyone, an anxious silence falls over those petrified partiers, and slowly the fingers form curves and dots and lines, and everybody knows this. These are letters. It is a language of some kind, but it was as foreign in meaning to them as if we had Chinese written on our walls in here today. Such intense fear grips Belshazzar that his appearance changed. Perhaps his face, which was flushed with wine, immediately went white as a sheet. Right? What does this mean? I mean, fingers writing on a wall, that can't be anything good, right? He could hardly stand. Verse 6 describes his knees knocking together as he quakes in fear. It's very possible that phrase in verse 6, the joints of his loins were loosed and tense, for us to understand, Belshazzar was so stricken with terror that he wept himself. He doesn't seem to be afraid of the enemy at the gate, but he is shaking in his shoes from a few fingers inside the palace. Look, God can do that. He can shake things when he wants to. In Haggai 2, verse 7, God says he will shake the nations until the desire of all nations comes. He did it to Belshazzar, and he will do it to all nations someday. It would do us good to remember that the God we worship is a shaker of nations. And in verse 7, the king shrieks, right? Bring the astrologers, bring the wise men, bring the enchanters. Right, somebody gather the brain trust. Whoever can interpret this supernatural graffiti is going to be rewarded with treasures and title. You'll get to be, what does he say? The third ruler in the kingdom. Why the third ruler? Well, because Belshazzar and Nabonidus were co-rulers of the kingdom. The end of verse 7 is a statement that didn't make sense to much until archaeology finally caught up with the Bible. What we find is the wisest counselors are hopelessly ignorant when it comes to this handwriting on the wall. The greatest wisdom in the world is foolishness before God. These useless worshipers of their useless idols were useless to interpret that divine graffiti. And so enter the queen in verse 10. While it says she is the queen, think more like the queen mother. This is possibly the aged widow of Nebuchadnezzar himself, or perhaps it's Nebuchadnezzar's daughter who Nabonidus had married. So this is either Belshazzar's mother or grandmother. I mean, it's just who you want to walk into a party like this, right? Either way, Daniel was well known to this woman. And she comes to Belshazzar and she comforts him and assures him, look, there is a man in the kingdom. A man so wise that Nebuchadnezzar had made him the master of these wise men. His name is Daniel. Let Daniel be called and he will tell you what this means. Daniel at this point is probably in his mid to early 80s. In chapter 1, Daniel the boy is willing to stand in defiance to the king's orders. In chapters 2 through 4, Daniel the man is willing to stand boldly before the king himself. And so now in chapter 5, we shouldn't be shocked to find that Daniel the old man is still going to be fearless in facing down Belshazzar, even knowing that this would be the very night that would bring the collapse of the Babylonian Empire, just as he had prophesied to Nebuchadnezzar. So Daniel is called. It's hard to imagine Daniel, the old man, walking into that banquet hall. The sight of the revelry disgusting to him. And how long before he realized that the goblets and dishes strewn about the room were from the temple in Jerusalem. And there's some apparent niceties that pass from the king to Daniel, including the promise of wonderful gifts and rewards. But actually, I don't think they're that nice at all. Look at the first words Belshazzar speaks to Daniel. Verse 13. Then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said unto Daniel, are you that Daniel which are of the children of the captivity of Judah, who the king my father brought out of Jewry? Now he tells Daniel that I have heard of you in verse 14, but it has been some time since Nebuchadnezzar had honored Daniel and his three friends, and in that time they have somehow fallen from prominence. The mention of the Hebrew God and that prophecy of the Hebrew God that the Babylonian Empire would fall, that was an offense to their mindset. They don't want to hear about that. And so when Daniel comes in, Belshazzar is full of contempt. He's probably holding one of the vessels of the temple in Jerusalem, arrogantly drinking wine from it. And the first thing that he says to Daniel is, "Aren't you from there? Didn't my father Nebuchadnezzar bring you out of Jerusalem just like he brought this? You're here to be used by me." Now, since he's already made that promise that whoever interprets the word would be made third in the kingdom, he repeats that promise to Daniel in verse 16. Belshazzar could have hardly understood that he was offering the third position in a falling empire. And who cares? Who wants that? It's like being on an airplane that's about to crash into a mountain and somebody offers to make you a co-pilot. How would you like to be assistant co-pilot? What good does it do? Verse 17, Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be to yourself, and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known unto him the interpretation." Right? Daniel says, "Look, keep it. But I am going to read those words to you. I'm going to tell you exactly what they mean." But before Daniel does that, he repeats briefly the story of chapter 4. Right, let me just paraphrase briefly verses 17 through 23. Daniel says, "Look, all right, king, let's start with a history lesson. The Most High God, you know, the one that your party is mocking, that is the God who made Nebuchadnezzar great. And all the kingdom and majesty and glory and honor that he ever accumulated, it all came from God. And when Nebuchadnezzar was arrogant and proud, God humbled him till he finally bowed down in reverence to the Most High God. And now you, Belshazzar, the descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, you know all this, but you still dared to bring the vessels of the temple and mock Yahweh, the sovereign God of heaven and earth. You use them to worship and to praise your false idols who see nothing and hear nothing and know nothing and do nothing. And you refuse to glorify the true God, even though the next breath you breathe is in his hand. And so God sent those fingers to write these words. Mene, mene, to call you farsa. And this is what the words mean. It means numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. Picture two scales, right? That two-sided scale that was used to say measure out anything of value, like produce or whatever. And they look sort of like the scales of justice with two areas on opposite sides of the balance. This is how you're going to find out if things add up, if they're equal. Number, number, weighed, divided. It may be that those words are describing the process of putting things on the scale and seeing and making a determination. But Daniel is going to go beyond reading the words, and he's going to tell Belshazzar what it means. In verses 26 through 28. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. To call, thou art weighed in the balance and are found wanting. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. How much courage must it have taken for Daniel to stand before this petulant king and tell him, look, your number is up. God has determined that you don't measure up. He is separating you from your kingdom. Now, the Bible doesn't actually record the means of how that happens. It only records the maker of the means. But we know Babylon fell, and it fell quickly according to God's plans. Because the Medes and Persians out there were not simply making some ramp to try to get over the wall. They weren't doing, digging earth to get under the wall. They were actually digging canals to divert the Euphrates River. The Euphrates flowed under the walls of Babylon. And they dug canals to divert it into some basin, and it dropped the river's water level enough that soldiers could just wade under the walls, walk right in, penetrate the city. They took Babylon with hardly a fight. Verse 30 says, "And that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain." Right? No more crown, no more scepter. That golden goblet from God's temple falls from his fingers as his life is dispatched by some unknown, anonymous Medo-Persian soldier. And then who is left to surrender the kingdom of Babylon? Daniel's just been made the third of the kingdom. Maybe he had the pleasure of surrendering the empire to the Medo-Persians. Now there is some debate about who Darius the Mede is in verse 31. It may be the general who is in charge of the army. Some think this is Cyrus's uncle. Others think Darius, which means kingly, is a title that's given to Cyrus himself. But history tells us that Cyrus was there at Babylon's defeat. The God of Israel, the ruler of history, he is the shaker of nations, and he just hands the Babylonian Empire to a man named Cyrus, a man that people are going to call king, but almost 200 years before this, God called him my shepherd, my anointed. I'm going to deliver my people through a man named Cyrus. Oh, I know you've never heard of him, but just watch. Two quick applications of this chapter and we'll be finished. First off, God is in control of the worst circumstances of your life. I've mentioned before that the country song from a while back, "Jesus Take the Wheel," and I always just want to say, wait a minute. You think you've been steering? It is a mistake to think that the sovereign God of history ever takes his hand off the steering wheel. Even when circumstances make it seem like he's absent, right? What's happening here is the people of Judah are captives in a strange land. The leader of that land who had come to know God is now dead. There are now wicked leaders who mock God, and they've come to power. Any prominence that Daniel and his friends have seems to have fallen by the way. There is not seeming to be the slightest hope that Babylon is going to release God's people. And now there's enemies outside the gate. You know, God can make the enemies at the gate your best friend. Only God can weigh a leader and determine that he doesn't add up. Only God can look at an empire and say, look, your number's up. Only God can shake nations and divide the debris. And if God does all of that on a global scale, what is it that you think he's able to do in your life? He was in control of Judah's darkest days, and he was able and determined to bless them according to his promise. He has a plan. There's application. That's the application for the people of God. There's also application for the unbelieving Belshazzars of the world, too. You may be partying away with the immorality and pleasures of this world, and you may think that you are somehow a long way from judgment, but your pride and your self-confidence are an offense to God, and even now, the handwriting is on the wall. This chapter is where that phrase comes from, by the way. Listen, what Belshazzar receives in Daniel chapter 5 is actually the fondest hope of every self-righteous religionist of the world today. His life is going to be weighed in the balance. How many times have you heard someone express their eternal hope by saying, well, I believe if you just do enough good things to outweigh the bad things, God's going to be pleased with you. How did that work out for Belshazzar? That kind of judgment, this is the end goal of every system of religion in the world, but it is the hope of fools. When Belshazzar raised that cup of God to his lips, toasting those pagan gods, he might as well have been drinking poison. You have to ask yourself, does sin have more appeal to you than Jesus? Because it certainly cannot do for you what Jesus can do. Listen, it is very possible that you are partying your life away, having yourself a good time, and ignoring the fact that judgment is quickly coming. And God's message to you is not much different than it was to Belshazzar. God knows your life and your days are numbered. He's judged your life and his balance, and you do not measure up, right? All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But thankfully, he sent his son Jesus, who can remove the sin from the judgment side of the scale and add his righteousness to the righteousness side of the scale, and only he can make the balances right. Just as surely as God fulfilled his word concerning Cyrus, he will fulfill his word concerning Jesus. God spoke, and about 200 years later, he shook Babylon and he handed it over to Cyrus. The same God has spoken. We are patiently awaiting a day that he is going to shake the nations again, and he is going to give them over to his son, King Jesus. And without Jesus, your days are numbered. Your life doesn't measure up. You will be divided from your Creator into everlasting torment. But if you're part of his kingdom by faith, you're going to find King Jesus throwing an entirely different kind of banquet. It'll be an eternal celebration of the righteousness and praise of Yahweh, the one true God. Amen. Brother Larry, come here.